This is Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel. Recap and reckoning. I'm going to do something a little different this time around. I'm usually, for the last several podcasts, I've actually had an entire post, an article, basically, written up. In the past, I've written it up after the fact. I do a pretty detailed outline and then work off of that for the podcast and then polish it up to make the final post. But most recently, what I've figured is if I'm going to do it anyway, I might as well do it before I speak and then speak to that article. But this time, I honestly don't have the time this week to put the amount of effort that I normally put into my podcasts into this one. And so this time I'm going to be working from just a brief set of notes. I want to talk a bit about the topics that I've been talking about for the last half year or so, and especially for these last 2 or 3 months. If you are interested in the sorts of things that I'm interested in, then you'll have noticed my Twitter feed. And I was very skeptical about Twitter at first. I didn't think it was worth getting into, and I saw it for a long time as basically just another way of announcing new material being available, new blog posts or new podcasts, and that's how I used it on the White Network, and that's how I even used it myself for a while after the White Network. But this summer, I really took more of an interest in reading other people's feeds in addition to posting my own feeds. And then once I started to see what other people were twittering about, I started to do so myself. And I saw that the value of it as a what they call microblogging, that and it actually serves a good purpose for me. I tend to like to write fairly detailed pieces. When I sit down to think about a subject, I like to invest quite a bit of effort in it and write something that will last and something that is well thought out. And what Twitter offers is it sort of forces a very brief, stripped down to the bare essentials type of reaction to things. And so it's, in that sense, it really is microblogging. It's really nothing more than a title, basically, for some link that you want to bring to other people's attention. And so if you like the kind of stories that I generally do focus a lot of energy on, and but want to see the things that I see on a day-to-day basis and see my take on them, then follow my Twitter feed, which is available on the website, and take a look at what some of the other people are twittering about. I follow, in particular, Alex Linder is very chatty, very lots of insights on a daily basis into what's going on, current events. But other people that I follow are similar. One of the events part of the value of Twitter and being able to microblog as the things are happening is that certain major things like the Gaza bombing by the Israelis this summer and the whole Ferguson thing for months and months, I think I only wrote maybe one blog post on each of those, if even. But I did lots and lots of Twitters on or twits on each of those subjects. And so it's a that's where a lot of the energy goes, instead of into big fat blog posts, into that microblogging. Another thing where my energy has gone in the last since about December is this thing called T-Feed, which has worked out pretty well. I think it's what I wanted it to be, which is a place where I could put audio that I wanted to listen to myself that wasn't already in a feed, but also to flesh it out with things that I knew were good, things that I wanted to hear again that I had heard before, or that things that I wanted to share with other people, but were audio, in a putting it in an RSS feed is a very convenient way to listen to it. If you have a smartphone or an iPod, something like that, it's easy to subscribe to a feed and then just be notified and with a single click, whenever there's new content, be able to download it and listen to it. And the other value of a reader like that is that it will keep track of where you are in the audio. So if you do get interrupted while listening, it's easy to start back up again. You don't have to find your place. The content that I've put up, again, Alex Linder happened in December to have started up a series of book readings with commentary. And one of the ones that I had always wanted to do myself was Revel Oliver's Jewish Strategy. A tremendously valuable book. You should get it and own it yourself and read it yourself. A very short book, but just packed and dense with Revel Oliver's lifetime worth of wisdom about our Jewish problem and the nature of it. And really, Alex Linder did a great job in his series of podcasts, added a lot of context to what Revel Oliver was talking about, and did a better job than I ever could have done on reading the Jewish Strategy. So that's one of the main things that I've put in T-Feed. But other things, interviews with Kevin McDonald and other people that I'm interested in hearing the points of view of. A couple of podcasts that I've put in there are from Bill Rise concerning Anders Breivik. And I put a lot of time and energy into trying to understand Anders Breivik several years ago when he first launched his attacks and then when he went to trial. And so I was glad to be reminded of that case and to see somebody else take an interest in it and to see him similarly to how I do, which is as a European, a nationalist who was trying in his own way to fight back. Other things that have gone on T-Feed, and I think I'll continue this along in the same vein, which is why it's worth reviewing what I've already put up there. But the Fable of the Ducks and the Hens, the very good short story by George Lincoln Rockwell. Again, the nature of the Jews reduced down to a children's fable. And read by Edgar J. Steele, that was a classic. Now, there are some sour notes in the things that I put in T-Feed, and this is part of why I put it in a separate feed to itself, is not everything that I put there am I sure it's going to be great. Now, in the case of an interview with Colin Liddell and Andy Nowicki, I had listened to it ahead of time, and I had already written an article about Andy Nowicki and his problem with the Jews. And he's one of these alt-right guys. In fact, the two of them literally run a website named Alt-Right. And part of the problem with the alt-right is that they're constantly downplaying the role of the Jews and instead pointing their finger at anti-Semites. That's the real problem. And that if only the anti-Semites would shut up, they could solve all of the problems. Because the Jews aren't as big a problem as the anti-Semites say they are. And that interview, which was on Red Ice Radio, which is actually very good and has very good interviews most of the time, it's really kind of a facepalm to listen to the two of them make excuses for the Jews. And it's educational, I guess, in that respect. It's not a total waste of time to know that those two guys, you never really need to take them seriously because of that attitude that they have. And they're typical, I think, of these people who over-intellectualize and dig into philosophy, looking for answers there or thinking that the answers are there. They aren't, and they're really just looking for excuses not to talk about the harsh reality, which is dominated by the Jews. I started a series in December that I've interrupted and we'll come back to the genetics primer I did two segments on that, and there's more to talk about: meiosis, mitosis, crossover mutations, chromosomes, haplotypes, and you know, the final thing that everyone's interested in, which is these genetic tests, and what do they mean when you get a genetic test? What does it really tell you? I want to know myself, and so I thought I would that would be part of the value of doing that series. In January, there was the attack on Charlie Hebdo, and I came back and interrupted that Genetics Primer series to talk about that. And I thought that's really been, for the last 2 months, that was the start of a series that wasn't really identified as a series, but is all logically connected. The basically, the Hebdo thing, the takeaway from that was Hebdo, the what Hebes do, the how they talk about free speech while they're actually taking away or proposing that governments take away the power for anyone to criticize them or mock them or ridicule them or in any way contradict what they have to say politically and or about history. And this goes straight to this Jewish rule. And the worship of Jews, the it's not recognized as such, but that's really what it comes down to, is these secular political leaders that when you listen to them talk about the Jews on the occasions when they do, it is with reverence and it is with a level of respect that they don't give to any other people or any other religion, really. But it is on the same level of a religion. It's Jew worship. And that this is directly connected, of course, to the Jewish narrative of their history, their relations with Europeans, especially through time, as being the victims, the eternal victims of Europeans, and that their Europeans are their eternal victimizers. And, you know, the Holocaust being the, and their Holocaust narrative being the cornerstone of that now. But, you know, a point I've made in the past, and part of why I haven't harped on the Holocaust myself, is because I see it really just as the largest and most recent piece in a long series. Before there was the Holocaust, they had their blood libel, you know, what Europeans call ritual murder by Jews. The Jews interpret from their point of view as a blood libel, that it's a libel against them. And their narrative of that, of course, is that they're completely innocent and that it's these stupid, crazy, evil Europeans that are just making stuff up, even though these stupid, crazy, supposedly stupid, crazy, evil Europeans aren't in communication with each other. And these stories about ritual sacrifice, ritual murder of non-Jewish children span time and space of groups of people that had no communication with each other, and there's the only common element is the Jews. And this is related, of course, to their theory of anti-Semitism as well, that anti-Semitism has nothing to do with the Jews, it's just some mental disease and disorder in Europeans. And this is really the zeitgeist. This Jewish narrative is the current zeitgeist of Western governments, Western media, Western politics. It's the backdrop of all political discourse. The minute the going gets tough in the debate about any debate having to do with race or immigration or even economics, it goes back to the button that they push is the Holocaust, the Jewish narrative. You've got to do these things, otherwise, you know, people are going to get loaded into boxcars and taken to concentration camps, and they're going to be exterminated. And that's how it works. And, you know, I think it's actually kind of a feedback cycle, that the outrageous lies that the Jews tell aren't why they're in power, but because they are in power, they're able to tell these outrageous lies. And it's actually, you know, then telling the lies reinforces their power, and it goes back and forth like that. But they couldn't get away with these outrageous lies if they didn't already have massive political, media, financial power. a recent story and something that I might have dedicated this podcast to if I had had more time to focus on it, is what I call Parasite Flight. These series of stories, this sort of thread of mainstream media op-eds and articles about how the Jews are fleeing Europe again, that there must be something wrong with Europe and Europeans because there's an exodus of Jews from Europe because of these attacks on Jews. And it's really, it's part of this Hebdo thing. It's an extension of it. But it started before. It goes back to the Gaza bombing when the Israelis were bombing unarmed Palestinians at schools and hospitals and so forth all across the world. People were aghast at this, that they had there was a military, a Western-style, well-armed military was dropping military ordnance on civilians. And at the time, I remember writing about it, how the even the liberal comedians, liberal Jewish comedians in the United States were, you know, they weren't criticizing Israelis for doing this. They were criticizing anyone who was criticizing the Israelis, and they were aghast at the what they could see, and the terms they put it in was the loss of moral legitimacy, of moral, the moral high ground was the term that they used. They could see that Israel was losing that moral high ground that they supposedly see themselves. And this, again, back to the Jew worship, the nature of this zeitgeist and how they realize that they are treated as if they're being worshiped, by secular governments throughout the West, and they saw that as a threat. And that's really where the roots of these recent efforts that are just coming out in the news now to clamp down on hate speech and consider anti-Semitism or criticism of Israel to be anti-Semitism, and so therefore it should be treated just like anti-Semitism and outlawed and punished and criminalized. It didn't come from the Charlie Hebdo attacks or this recent attack in Denmark. The roots go back farther than that. But back to Parasite Flight, that's something I haven't talked about before. I've used the hashtag Parasite Flight on stories on when I send tweets about these stories, because that's what it is. It reminds me of the enormous contrast between when whites decide that a situation is no good and pick up and leave from, say, Detroit or California or any place where we're being replaced and our lands are being colonized and foreigners are flooding in, and we realize that the government isn't going to support us. White people for generations or decades, and I suppose generations too, have been fleeing, and they call that white flight. And of course it's the white people's fault for fleeing. They never say that white people are just looking for a better life for themselves and their families. That's only something that they say about non-whites, and that's something that they say about Jews. If Jews pick up and leave someplace, it's not because they made a mess. It's not because they demanded open borders, and now the people that that they told the governments that they had to welcome, otherwise Holocaust, are attacking Jews, and they're not really attacking Jews anyway. But that's the idea behind these Parasite Flight stories, is it's never told. The story is never told in that fashion, that it's their own fault for encouraging open borders. Instead, it's like they would say about Mexicans or the Muslims. They're just looking for a better life for themselves outside of France, outside of Europe, because Europeans are horrible and don't keep it nice and safe for the Jews. In fact, when you read these stories, I'll maybe link one in my program post. I'm not going to have a detailed program post for this, but I'll put a few links in it. The epitome of this style of story is from Roger Cohen recently in the New York Times, an op-ed. It's, you know, again, a liberal, a supposed liberal, who is this tremendously hyper-ethnocentric Jew who's really just worried about the Jews. And to the point where when he talks about Europe, he talks about it as a continent. It's just a plot of land where Jews live. And, you know, and this is a theme that runs through all of these stories, that Europeans aren't people to be concerned about. They're just, you know, hosts. And this is where the parasite view, the parasitism is a better way of understanding Jewish mentality than any other I've ever encountered. In fact, even the word hyperethnocentrism, as I talked about in the fall in that series, Race and the Jews, what I pointed out is it's really impossible to understand the Jews as just another group and say things like, Jewish racism is the worst racism of all. It's not even in the same league. Their idea of themselves, their consciousness of themselves and their own needs as a group is there's just nothing comparable to it. There's no other group that compares, and they really should be treated that way. So words like hyperethnocentrism just don't apply. Racism doesn't apply. Loxism, Alex Linder's suggested word for it, is better, or Jewism is, I think, better, but not as well known or not as popular, not as specific. So after the Charlie Hebdo series of podcasts and things having to do with that, I moved on to pathology and pathogen. And as I say, seeing the Jews as a parasitic organism rather than as a competing group or as yet another group of human beings that are just, competing for resources and that we have to argue with or something, that this idea of seeing them as a pathogen, as a parasitic organism, it actually fits the reality better. And it also helps to understand what we might do, what white people might do to put an end to this cycle. Fear and Genocide was the next podcast in the series, continuing the same thought, and Gaslighting, the most recent. I got some pushback there because I really delved into this whole idea of white pathology and made the connection to psychoanalysis, which is where I started with pathology and pathogen. The idea being that the Jews create this pseudo-scientific idea that of psychoanalysis, and part of psychoanalysis is that anti-Semitism is a mental disorder in non-Jews, and it just comes out of nowhere for no reason whatsoever, not having to do with the Jews, and that this idea of white pathology is a sort of internalization of this idea that there's something wrong with white people. And although the intent is 180 degrees different and is sympathetic to whites in a sense that the people spouting white pathology really want whites to not behave this way and supposedly want to fix it, I don't see actually much of an emphasis on getting to the details. Well, what exactly is it that's wrong? And how exactly could we fix it? And that's what I think the parasitology and seeing the Jews as a pathogen actually does help to explain, because it makes more sense, and it actually does have some prescriptive promise to it that there's something that can be done about it besides just blaming ourselves for somehow being genetically flawed, that we're just victimized by Jews forever and doomed to be like this forever because we suck. It's more of a scientific model to see it as parasitism. Pathological altruism is a sort of subset of white pathology where it's mainly Jared Taylor, as far as I can tell, that's pushing this idea of pathological altruism, but it is more specific than just some broad white pathology, and I'll have to focus a little bit maybe another time on pathological altruism. I got some pushback from Greg Johnson on that last Gaslighting because he perceived me as making a personal attack or an attack on Kevin MacDonald, and that my seeing a similarity between this white pathology idea and psychoanalysis was I was just playing word games. He said, you're depending on word games here. Let's flip the table. Forget about pathology, because he thought I was fixating on the word pathology. Let's talk about white vulnerabilities to Jewish subversion. Now, Greg, I don't think, has been listening, because that's my point, is that the people who talk about white pathology are not talking about vulnerabilities to Jewish subversion. Not MacDonald so much, although when MacDonald brings up, and Andrew Joyce as well, they do talk about the Jews. But then white pathology is the idea that there's something else besides what the Jews are doing that is wrong with whites. And when you look at somebody like Jared Taylor, or Ricardo Duchesne, it's really obvious that all they could be talking about is something that has nothing to do with the Jews. So they are actually, when they talk about white pathology, it's not about white vulnerabilities to Jewish subversion. It's just how whites suck. The Jews and their subversion is off the table. It's not being discussed. And that's what I want discussed. That's what I want people to discuss, because that's the reality. That's what causes the problems that these people are complaining about, or at least exacerbates them to the point where it becomes deadly to the white race. Greg saw me as wanting to stigmatize Kevin MacDonald with what he called a weak argument, or I forget the words that he used exactly, but it didn't make sense to me, except as him just white knighting Kevin MacDonald coming to his defense, because he got my argument so wrong. And if my argument was as weak as and shallow as he said it was, then what effect would it have on Kevin MacDonald? None. So another response that I got, that not a big response, but I've seen this before, is we all know everything we need to know about the Jews. Now we need to know what's wrong with us. And I think, we don't know everything we need to know about the Jews. I don't know everything I need to know about the Jews. And I specialize in that. I have specialized in it for years now. I think the average white nationalist, or even person who considers themselves racially aware and Jew aware, doesn't really understand it. And that's part of the argument here, is that I'm arguing that it should be seen as a parasitic relationship between whites and Jews, not as competition between different European groups, because that's not what it is. And you see a lot of people like Colin Liddell, Andy Nowicki, and the larger group of people that they represent, these alt-right people, the neo-reactionaries, the men's rights people, the conservatives in general, that really don't understand or don't want to understand the Jews and the relationship with whites. Never mind talking about it being parasitism. They don't even want to talk about Jewish influence and the negative impact that it has on whites. And that's about it. I'm going to take some time off. I think I'm going to not be able to podcast for probably about a month, maybe a little bit longer. I need to do some things offline. I need to catch up. And in the meantime, if you like the kind of things that I do do in my podcasts, tune into T-Feed. I'm going to continue to maintain that. That's not very much work to find things to recommend there and things I'm curious to listen to myself. And check my archives. I've been talking now for almost 3 years, coming up soon, 2.5 years. And I've talked about a lot of different subjects, a lot of the stuff that I'm talking about to this very day. I've laid the groundwork for and researched over the course of the last 2.5, 3 years. I'm not just pulling it out of thin air. And I haven't really changed all that much either. The things that I laid down 2.5, 3 years ago wasn't wrong. I was still learning, but because I invested the time in trying to understand it properly, I think I did it right, and I really don't have anything to correct about it. So I am proud of that work, and I urge you to go back and listen to it, because I think you might get some value out of it too. I'll see you again in a few weeks.